Illinois is home to some of America's most segregated cities, not just Chicago, but also Peoria, Rockford, and Springfield. Here's Rockford pastor Kenneth Board speaking to Governing Magazine.
So I say it is worse because, at least in the South, a black person, black males, black female, you can get a job. Here, you can't even get a job.
Plus, have you checked this week's forecast? Pretty much the entire state is below zero. Meteorologist Andrew Pritchard helps us prepare. But first, the government is finally open after the longest shutdown in American history. The state of Illinois still wants to fund $100 million in low or zero interest loans to people who've been affected. Here's Treasurer Mike Frerix.
We cannot stand on the sidelines and not help those who simply want to help themselves and their country. Missing a paycheck, or two, or maybe more, has real consequences.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. I hope everyone's getting prepared for the extreme cold weather we are going to be facing this week. Today's our breather day from what's ahead. Later this hour, meteorologist Andrew Pritchard will be joining us. Plus, later this hour, we're also going to take an extensive look at what segregation looks like across the entire state of Illinois. But first, how much savings do you have for emergencies? Hundreds of thousands of federal workers and contractors have been dealing with such an unexpected emergency, the fact that their employer, the federal government, was shut down for 35 days. About 12,500 federal workers live right here in Illinois, and those workers have missed two entire paychecks. Now that the government has reopened, they're likely to get paid, hopefully this week, by Friday. If you're a federal contractor, you are not getting back pay. Over the last week, Illinois organizations have been stepping up to provide some help, whether it's food banks, credit unions, even the state government. We are going to be hearing from State Treasurer Mike Frerix and U of I Community Credit Union's Senior Vice President Greg Anderson in just a minute. But first, Christine Vitale is with us. She's a TSA officer at O'Hare International Airport. She's coming to us actually on the line from Justice, a suburb on the city's south side. Hi, Christine. Good morning. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, good morning to you. Thank you.
Christine, I imagine the past 35 days have been pretty long for you. How are you feeling this morning?
Well, right now we're still in the same boat. As you know, the shutdown still affects us since we have not been paid yet. We were informed that we should be paid by the end of the week, but it's not our full back pay.
And it's not your full back pay. How much did you work, Christine, over the past month?
I went to all the holidays. I was there every day except for my days off, unless I had a scheduled day off.
And so for the holidays, do you normally get extra pay as well then, if you work through all the holidays?
We are supposed to be paid for that, but this week we're supposed to be getting 40 hours of our pay, which will cover our insurance, so our insurance don't expire.
Okay.
And then, I every day it changes, so, you know, we will get paid. That they have to, but, you know, our holidays and everything like that will not be on until our next paycheck, which is in February.
And I mean, I think for everyone listening right now, thinking about the idea of missing two paychecks would be pretty difficult, I think, for most people. What are some of your biggest financial obligations right now? How have you handled all of this?
I guess you could say not very well. January and as of right now, February lot rent that I have, I own a mobile home, but I rent a lot. And I have not paid January or, you know, so far February's lot rent. So that's affected me mentally and physically for the fact that, you know, I can't sleep because I'm trying to figure out how the heck am I going to pay this lot rent. They just started working with me. I spoke with them on Friday after the government opened up. And, you know, I told her I'll let her know when we get paid. You know, I mean, I can't do anything else about it. You know, I feel like I'm trapped because I can't really do anything Thursday, today, and I have it set up for tomorrow. I only have a quarter tank of gas in my car. So I got to try and figure out how I'm going to get gas in my car to hopefully be able to make it to work on Wednesday when it's that brutally cold. I don't have a garage, so I don't know. I don't know. It's the gas getting to work and getting my lot rent.
Christine, it just sounds like I just really feel for you listening to the stress in your voice as you're describing everything. Do you feel like, are you hoping at least for the next couple of weeks you'll have a little bit of relief from this?
there's too much catch up to even feel that until it goes back into the norm of us getting our paycheck biweekly. Me personally, I know I wouldn't be stressing about it till I pack, you know, pay all these back people that I owe. So, I mean, I don't know. I don't know how I'm going to feel. It puts, you know, I've been with my agency over 16 years. I started in 02. So it's really, really disappointing to see that we had to work with no pay.
And are you worried that, so you're not sure when you're going to get a paycheck. Hopefully you'll get a paycheck by Friday. Then 3 weeks from now, are you worried that you are going to be back in the same situation?
I am. I am the legislative political coordinator for Local 777, AFG, which I do the political side. In February, I will be in Washington. You know, so, I mean, I've worked with Tammy Duckworth and Dick Durbin quite a bit during these few weeks and everything. And they really, really are trying really hard for all our agencies that were affected by the shutdown.
So what is your message to all the elected officials in Washington who might be listening to this then?
I just hope that we don't have to go through this again. Everybody stated that we should have put money aside. Well, when you're not getting a paycheck, you can't put money aside. And a lot of us, you know, live paycheck by paycheck. Don't shut it down again because it will affect more people than they even realize. I mean, it's not only people that work for the government. It's other people, you know, everyday people. It's going to affect businesses. It's going to be a downroll effect. So I hope they don't shut it down again.
We've been talking to Christine Vitel, a TSA officer at O'Hare, and I've got a couple folks in studio who probably have some advice and maybe help they can offer Christine as well. Mike Frerix is with us. He's the Illinois State Treasurer. Greg Anderson is also the Senior Vice President of the University of Illinois Community Credit Union. And you guys have put together some programs to hopefully help people like Christine, Mike?
Yeah, the idea is we make investments in the treasurer's office, and we work with banks and credit unions. We put money into those banks, and so we set up a linked deposit program to offer zero or low-interest loans to federal employees who need cash to pay their rent, to pay tuition, to put gas in their car, all those things Christine was talking about.
So that's available, actually, for Christine now?
Well, because the shutdown is now over, some banks we're working with will continue it, but we think it's pretty likely that after this three-week extension is over, there's still not going to be a resolution, and employees like Christine might find themselves going without a paycheck again.
Mm-hmm. Greg, what is the how many folks, so Christine has been sharing her story. I wonder how many calls or situations you've heard like Christine's with the University of Illinois Community Credit Union, which is based here in Champaign-Urbana, but services people throughout the state and the country.
Yeah, we do. And when we started hearing this really right after Christmas, I mean, it was kind of looming. The shutdown had just started right before the holiday. And then as our members were starting to ask, hey, what happens if we don't get paid in January? What can you do? So we started getting those questions over the phone or in our branches, you know, kind of that Christmas to New Year's and into the new year. So I would say we had dozens of people asking, and that got us, you know, thinking about what we could do to put some things in place. And we've been down this road in the past with state budget stalemates that have, you know, been avoided or not, but being prepared for those. There's been some other federal things with sequesters and things and university budgets and things. So we have some things ready to go. So when that first paycheck was missed early January, we were able to put some things in place. So we had you know, quite a few inquiries, and then since then we've been able to help at least a dozen members, I'd say, that I'm aware of, and I don't hear everything that happens, of course.
And so some of the things you put in place, Greg, are those for your members? So, for example, if you have a loan with the credit union, what kinds of things have you offered people who are not being paid right now?
Yeah, we put in for our members, they might have a loan with us, and we have a normally throughout the year, there's a skip a payment option where people can pay a service fee and skip a payment. It helps their budget going into Christmas, or maybe they've got some seasonal employment or something. We're able to offer that for affected workers without the normal fee for that. So it helps this month. You don't have to make that payment. We're able to push the due date out a month, so you're not delinquent either. It's not like skipping a payment and not making it. It just readjusts the loan. So they were able to do that without the normal service fee because that's just going to help them along. We also put in place a 0% loan with 90 days till the first payment. Again, you had to come in with proof of your being affected by the shutdown. But that allows you to kind of keep your budget going because, again, a lot of members and a lot of the population are paycheck to paycheck, like the caller, your first guest was speaking of. So we wanted to put that in place as well. The final thing specific to this was people that had certificate investments where it's a 12 or 24-month certificate or something where you normally have a penalty to break that early. We'd allow that to break into that without the penalty. So, again, it's kind of that, are you prepared to have some savings or not? And if you do, let's not charge you to get at that and use that in this situation.
I want to come back to that with you guys in just a minute here. But, Christine, can I just ask, when you're thinking about your bills, I know you talked about rent and gas. I don't know if you've talked to your landlord about this situation that you're a federal worker, if there's been any ability to have any understanding there.
I did. December 28th was our last paycheck. And because I've been with the government for over 16 years, we've been through this before. So what I did is we got a paycheck on December 28th. I did not get any of my differentials, which means from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m., you get like a little percentage because, you know, you're working nighttime hours like overnight. My paycheck every 2 weeks, 40 hours of my paycheck is in a differential state. So when I got my paycheck, I didn't have none of my differentials on mine. Long story short is I paid all my smaller bills, my car payment, little bills, you know, my cell phone, you know, and whatever. And I thought I was going to be paid January 14th. So they worked it out with me. But January 10th, I received a five-day notice. And I did not know what a five-day notice was. I've never had a five-day notice, you know, my whole life. You know, I've never been late on my rent. You know, the latest I've ever paid was like the fourth of the month. You know, and it depended on my payday. Long story short is I called them up. The receptionist, which I found out is a collection lady, started threatening me. I said, well, there's nothing I could do. You know, basically, bottom line, she was threatening me, telling me that they were going to evict me. I said, but how can you evict me when I own the home? We're going to take away your home, too. We're going to take you to court to get you home. I said, well, for an $860-month lot rent, how can you take a $20,000 home? You know, so I talked to the manager, and she said that she was willing to work with me and just keep them posted. You know, and, you know, that's all I've been doing every week is letting them know. So I don't know if they're doing the process of taking me to court or not, but there is literally nothing I can do.
Right. And I wonder, in terms of your banks, if you have an opportunity, as we're just about to talk a little bit more about what the state is offering, if you've had an opportunity to go to any banks and ask if they have any interest-free loans available, Christine?
I have talked with my bank. What they did was let me say if I needed to overdraft up to $300, but if it had to go more, then they would work with me on that. I personally don't want to have to put it on another bill, because I have, you know, all these other bills that I had to catch up on. And, of course, trying to get a loan, that's putting extra bills on me that I would have to be paying, you know. Mm-hmm. And we are the lowest pay scaled agency for the federal government. So it's not like we make tons of money. You know, we make enough money just to hopefully have a roof over our head, to pay our electric, to pay, our, you know, get food, you know, pay for our gas or public transportation. You know, it's not like we have that much left after to really put into a savings and to create more bills. You know, I'm a single mom, you know, so it's not like I have any other income coming in but my own. So, I mean, I have talked to them, you know, that would have been the worst case scenario, but, you know, it was only for $300 is what we were offered, or I was offered from my bank.
Mm-hmm. And Christine, go ahead, Mike.
Well, I was going to say that if you do need cash, I mean, some sort of loan, there are banks, there are credit unions out there throughout the state who are willing to work with federal employees. A lot of them, if you're already a customer, we're making exceptions as well, as Greg pointed out. But you can go to our website in the Illinois Treasurer's Office at illinoistreasurer.gov and find some help there, or there's also a state website as well to help out.
Christine, what do you want other people to know? You've shared so much of your story, and I really appreciate that. For Illinois residents, maybe there are people who've been seeing this on TV or the people who are listening on the radio right now and thinking, oh, the federal shutdown's over. Everything's back to normal. What do you have to say about that?
Okay, now, mind you, this is just my opinion, but a lot of news media, social media has stated, we're getting paid, but we have not been paid yet. So we are still affected. Talk to an agent or a federal employee and find out their situation, because you cannot listen to what everything in the news is portraying, because we have not been paid. And like I said, we're still affected, and we will be affected maybe all the way to March, if the government doesn't shut down again. So maybe try and find a federal employee that is affected by the shutdown and talk to them. Don't listen to everything that you hear on the TV or social media. That's what I have to say to them, because I was affected by that by my own family.
Well, Christine, I really appreciate you sharing your story with us. That's Christine Vitale. She's a TSA officer at O'Hare International Airport in Chicago. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with State Treasurer Mike Frerichs, Greg Anderson with the University of Illinois Community Credit Union. They're going to tell us a little bit more about some of these bank programs that are being offered. $100 million to the state has offered $100 million to banks and credit unions to provide low to 0% interest loans. And we're going to also talk a little bit more just about the whole idea of savings as well. So stay tuned to the 21st. We're going to take a short break. We'll continue this conversation just after that.
Support comes from Krannert Arch Museum at the University of Illinois, presenting Renaissance to Modern Remix, highlights from the European and American art collection, and Between the Buildings, Art from Chicago, on view now. More information at kam.illinois.edu.
Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. In studio with me is Greg Anderson, who's a senior vice president at the University of Illinois Community Credit Union. State Treasurer Mike Frerichs is also with us. The state has offered $100 million in low and zero interest loans to banks and credit unions, and they're hoping it will help federal workers and contractors who've missed out on pay during the federal government shutdown that ended on Friday, as we were just hearing from TSA worker Christine Vitale at O'Hare. She still hasn't been paid yet. Treasurer Frerichs, when we're thinking about this, I'm obviously you put this program in place to try to help people, workers like Christine.
Yes. And Christine is not alone. If people want to give her advice, a report by the Federal Reserve Board found that 4 in 10 Americans can't cover a $400 emergency expense. If your tires blew out, you need 4 new tires. Most Americans don't have the savings to cover that. If they had unexpected visit to the hospital and had a $500 bill, they couldn't cover that. So I would say that this national emergency with the shutdown definitely became a personal emergency for thousands of federal workers.
And Greg, when we're thinking about that, I just wonder, as it's the time of year when people are trying to normally get finance in order to think about their taxes and things like that, are there savings tips or things that you can offer to us for people to keep in mind? Maybe this is a good reminder for other people, if possible, for them to try to save a little bit more for emergencies if they could.
Yeah, I think this time of year is a good time for this conversation, because people are looking at their finances. They want to ignore it most of the year a lot of times. But with taxes and so on, you do that, you might be getting an increase at work. So if you're in a situation where you have a little pay increase, that's also good news. But it kind of all falls under an umbrella of kind of a pay yourself first. You have a way to start some savings or increase your savings a little bit. And just to do something, as Treasurer Frerichs said, people without being able to cover an emergency? How can you build up something to start if you're going to try to build that $400 or $500 or $1,000? So obviously, you know, we like to help with a savings account that has a really no minimum balance and no fees for having an account, because that will eat into that savings. But are you able, if you get a tax refund, a one tip, you know, it's appealing to, you know, go make a purchase with that, but either to put some of that in savings or pay some debt down to get rid of that debt. That's an idea with that. Or if you have an increase because of the time of year, you get a normal salary increase or something, can you take some of that and put it away? And one of the ways to do that is through payroll deduction. If you have that option through your employer, into your credit union or bank or wherever it is, just so you don't see it and don't have to handle it. Sometimes out of sight, out of mind is
right.
A,
so if you set up maybe a payroll deduction for two accounts, like you have some of your paycheck going into one account and another going directly into a savings account.
Yeah, that is just basic human nature. We discover this on retirement savings. It's very easy to tell if someone is saving for their retirement or not. The determining factor is, do you have a workplace automatic payroll deduction or not? If it automatically comes out of your paycheck and you don't see it, you don't notice it, you're building savings. For people who don't have that option at work and they've got to go find a financial advisor, set up an account, they've got to write checks, most people just put that off and put it off. And that's why one of the things we're doing, it doesn't help federal employees right now, but for setting up a Secure Choice Retirement Savings Program in the Treasurer's Office, helping about 1.2 million people save some money for their retirement, save their own money so that they can hopefully enjoy their golden years.
One last question for you, Treasurer Frerichs, as we're ending here. You know, we were talking about this before we went on air, that essentially during the state budget impasse, this was a plan that you all had in place. You modeled this plan after that one. You mentioned concerns about the fact that 3 weeks from now, we may be back into another shutdown situation. I wonder if you think you worry about this becoming too normal, that we can't rely on our government for stability to operate, whether we're talking about the state of Illinois or the federal government?
That's a real fear, is that the public is becoming very cynical, because we talked at that time that 3.5 years ago, Governor Rauner couldn't reach an agreement with the General Assembly and the state didn't have a budget. Well, employees in the state's case went to the courts and they ruled if you show up to work, you have to be paid. So it took off some of the pressure and the state went 2 years without a budget. Now, that is not how government is supposed to work. We sure hope that doesn't become the new norm. We hope that the current elected officials learned a lesson from that. But one thing I will also say, though, is I have to make a plug. During that time when the state had no budget, we were still paying out unclaimed property. So if anyone out there is in need of cash, we suggest they go to IllinoisTreasurer.gov, click on iCash, and see if we have money that belongs. Then we find 1 in 4 people who check have money, and the average amount last year was $1,500.
Well, and that is money available for you. It is literally free money, as State Treasurer Mike Frerichs loves to point out. So we'll tweet out those links, by the way, and we'll have them at our website at 21stshow.org. And I want to thank Greg Anderson for being with us as well, U of I Community Credit Union. Guys, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Nyla, thank you very much.
Thank you.
America's racial divide runs right through the heartland. That's what Dan Vaught and Brian Charles write in an investigative series for Governing Magazine. And when they say heartland, they don't mean just the Midwest. They mean our heartland right in our state, central and northern Illinois, some of our biggest metro areas. And the numbers back it up. Illinois cities are some of the most racially segregated in the entire U.S., even though housing discrimination, for example, has been illegal since 1968. Peoria, Rockford, Springfield, Danville, Kankakee are all within the top one-third of most segregated areas. And in some metro areas, segregation hasn't changed much since the 1980s. Some of this has because of our country's long history of discrimination, but it also has to do with state and local policies in our much more recent past. Dan and Brian's four-part series is called Segregated in the Heartland. They wrote it for Governing Magazine. They're based in Washington, and they're on the line there with us now. Hi, guys. Welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having us.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
Dan, you talked to a lot of people for this series, and I wanted to start, though, by asking about a couple of Illinois residents in particular, and that's Silas Johnson in Springfield and Kenneth Board in Rockford, both of them Black men who moved to Illinois from the South. What did they tell you about what it was like to move from the South to Springfield and Rockford?
Well, both of them came, as you said, they grew up in the South during an era when the civil rights movement was still going on and the South was adjusting. Both of them, though, mentioned that when they came north, not only were they surprised by the level of sort of the racial divide, but also that they felt like in the South, the racial divisions were more out in the open. And that up north, it was more, it was hidden or covered up, or in some way, people didn't say what they meant when they were talking about race. So that there's a lot of euphemisms and sort of talking around things, but not straight out, you know, telling people what they believe.
You guys did so much research for this project. Brian, I wonder if you can help us just understand, first of all, what the legal, if we think about just the history of this, legal discrimination that happened before the Civil Rights Act, I'm thinking especially of housing discrimination policies like redlining. I think people think that happened a long time ago. That was decades ago. That still doesn't matter today.
Well, yeah, I think people have this idea that, well, redlining is a thing that became not legal. The Fair Housing Act kind of ends it for good, like it kind of puts it away. The problem with it is that what redlining did was it took whole sections of town, of certain towns, sections that were oftentimes the indicator for when you were going to redline an area was the presence of African-American families and men and women. And so what happens between the beginning of redlining in the 30s through the 60s is you see investment, federally backed loans, go into other neighborhoods that are not redlined, the other neighborhoods, right, but not into the redline neighborhoods. So you see an accumulation of wealth other places that has an echo effect. So by the time redlining ends, it becomes very difficult for those black families to even buy somewhere else or to have the necessary capital built up to do other things, you know, to buy homes or to even think about things like supermarkets and other things that would come into it. They would not come into an area because there was a lack of investment in the area.
So, Dan, I wanted to ask you about what this looks like, and let's take Springfield as an example. If you drove in Springfield on South Grand Avenue on the east side of the city, and if you kept going west, what would you see?
Well, so I actually lived in Springfield, and I made this drive many times. On the east side of Springfield, it's not a monolith. There are, you know, nice neighborhoods on the east side, but by and large, there are many blocks with vacant lots, you know, crumbling sidewalks, you know, sometimes there's no sidewalks, there's no shoulder to the roads, there's poor lighting. So you kind of get, obviously, there's not a lot of investment, not a lot of new businesses. There's some good restaurants there, you know, there's a lot of churches, that kind of deal. As you go sort of, as you go west, the big landmark is you go underneath this viaduct, and it's an old sort of hulking viaduct with, you know, two concrete walls on either side. It's like a gateway almost into the, you know, out of the east side. You go about a mile past downtown, you know, past another set of railroad tracks, and then all of a sudden you get into the west side where the street gets narrower. The tree canopy covers the whole street. There's beautiful mansions on either side. And then right next to there is sort of the crown jewel of the Springfield Park District, which is a beautiful park called Washington Park. There's a carillon and rose gardens. People are out walking their dogs, doing, you know, running around the track. There's a duck pond. A friend of mine got married there. I mean, it's really an attractive place. And if you look around, you know, there's, like I said, there's mansions and it's this very secluded, quiet place. And if you keep going past that, South Grand ends right there, again, because it's kind of secluded. But if you kept walking past or drive around, you'd see that, you know, then Springfield keeps sprawling to the west, and that's where all the development is, all the new, you know, retail and the new subdivisions that have gone in, and they're just pushing and pushing and pushing into cornfields. And I mean, you can literally stand in the driveways and see, you know, the combines go by, or, you know, the stalks of corn just, you know, from your driveway. So it's a huge contrast as you make the journey. Although if you're standing in one place, you may not see, you know, how stark that is, you know, unless you keep going.
And so that's, you can see that in the housing stock. And then you can also see in your reporting, you looked at one measure of how we look at income in disparity, income inequality, and that's median household income. And actually, so the data that you guys pulled, it says that median income of a Black household in Springfield is 42% that of a white household's income, Dan?
Yes, that's right. I forget the exact numbers, but the average white household makes about $63,000 in Springfield. So, you know, the Black household is about half of that. And, you know, I mean, that, I mean, you can, for some of the reasons that Brian mentioned, there's not a lot of wealth building that went on for generations. There's also disparities in education and all sorts of other resources, which all then, of course, translate into job opportunities. Another thing we talked about was sort of how Black neighborhoods are run in. Basically, they're more monitored, which means they run into the law enforcement more, which, if you have a criminal conviction, also limits your employment opportunities. So all these things sort of together, you know, start to build up that huge disparity in income.
Brian, Dan was talking about income. He also mentioned education. And I wondered if we could just think about education for a minute and think about a different city and think about Peoria. We've got lots of folks who are listening in Peoria as well as in Springfield. And I wonder, your analysis of federal data found that it's the most segregated metro area between Black and white students. What schools did you look at to learn more about that?
So we looked across the metro area. So we looked in Peoria and some of the areas around the city, and including across into the adjacent county. So, and that tells, and I want to be clear here, this is not an issue in which the core school district is largely segregated. I mean, they've gone through some court battles around that, and there's been some issues around that. What we're looking at here is we're looking at between districts, right? And the two places we looked at that kind of had the sharpest contracts, it was Peoria School District 150 and Dunlap School District, which actually takes in about the northern half of the city of Peoria. In fact, the majority of the students who go to Dunlap have Peoria mailing addresses. They live in homes within the city of Peoria. But the school district is doesn't have that many African Americans. Very low percentage of that is majority white. Has very few African American teachers. If you look at the campus, it's a beautiful, you know, well maintained, fairly new high school building. If you go to Peoria, into where school district 150 is, you see a school district that, you know, if you went back 30 years, they had a magnet program that attracted children from all different types of backgrounds. It was fairly racially balanced. There was a movement toward that, and that seemed to kind of die out. The numbers kind of show this, but I think one of the things that you see on the ground there is that among people who are familiar with this, they know that Dunlap schools is often used as a code for white schools. And for people who are coming, executives who are coming to work for Caterpillar, they're seeking out those particular schools. And so you see a disparity in these two districts. And if you dial into Roosevelt again, what was a magnet program is a magnet only in name now. It has now become a neighborhood school, and it's in 61605, which is an extremely poor zip code within the city of Peoria. It's been highlighted in a lot of different news outlets, including ours. And now we just have concentrated poverty in this school that used to be kind of the crown jewel for Peoria schools.
Brian, we have to take a break, but when we come back, we'll continue this conversation. We're speaking with Brian Charles and Dan Vock about their extensive reporting about what segregation looks like across Illinois. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guests are Brian Charles and Dan Vock. They're reporters with Governing Magazine, and they're sharing the details of their four-part investigation called Segregated in the Heartland. And it looks at our state's biggest metro areas outside of Chicago, Peoria, Rockford, and Springfield, as the most segregated between Black and white residents, as among the most segregated between Black and white residents in the entire country. We've been talking about Peoria and education. One of the people Dan interviewed was Kate Pastusha. She's a member of the Peoria County Board. Here's what she had to say about the school districts and racial segregation in Peoria County.
I'm calling it unintentional racism. I feel like everybody's making a decision for their family, what's best for them. But when you add up all of these people's individual decisions, what you get is white people leaving majority Black school district.
That's Kate Pastusha with Peoria County Board. Dan, as you think about that issue that she just brought up there, how much of this is about, I mean, we've seen this all over the country, right? Wealthier white residents leaving for suburban homes and school districts. I mean, we've seen this pattern all across the country. Is that what we're also seeing here in Peoria as well?
Well, there's definitely white flight going on throughout the country. There are more stark, if you look at the difference between, say, Tazewell County across the river from Peoria County, I mean, it's overwhelmingly white. So there are commonalities, and that's one thing that we are trying to use these smaller metro areas in Illinois to sort of have people see how this works. And if you take a sort of smaller area, it's easier to see the phenomenon. So, yes, the schools are driving people. One thing that we wanted to emphasize is people think that schools are segregated because of the neighborhoods they happen to be in. Well, we're trying to often schools are causing the neighborhoods themselves to be segregated, right? So when you're moving out to a Morton or, you know, to Dunlap or, you know, Chatham and Springfield, you're the white parent, then you're going to a place where other white parents are, creating a place where, reinforcing the segregation that you had. And you don't see, Black families able to do the same thing to a certain extent, partially because of income, partially because of where they're allowed to go. So twice as many, the percentages of Black families are renting compared to white families. And a lot of that goes back to the redlining and the stuff that Brian talked about. Well, if you don't have apartments that are allowed or only allowed in a very small part of one of these suburban areas, then the kids can't go to the schools and they can't get the opportunities. So you are seeing it on a grand scale. Obviously, one of the reasons we picked Illinois was because you're seeing it. It's very stark. It's a very stark example, but one that sort of illustrates the bigger trends that you're talking about.
And Brian, to that point, I wonder what you all spoke with lots of local leaders. You talked to the mayors of Rockford and Peoria and Springfield. I wonder how cities are trying to address this issue.
Well, you know, some of the reaction has been, what can a city do? And I think, and then there's been some reaction that has said, we need to start having a conversation. And I think that is a jumping off point about that. But I think cities need to think about everything from the way, let me back up. I think cities, counties, and states need to think about everything from the way we organize school districts, to the way we do things like choice and magnet in some states are some good examples of that, and places that have highly segregated schools where magnets have been really good at integrating them. I think we also need to have a conversation about things like zoning.
these aren't big federal policies like redlining or, you know, the Civil Rights Act or the Voting Rights Act. These are very local things, and these are things that people who are in power locally have some control over. I mean, your local city council and the mayor have some say often over zoning. You know, school districts, you know, kind of have some say over, you know, their faculty, you know, which was, you know, there are things in which local government can do, and in hopefully this highlights some of the places where they have fallen down, and they have some opportunities to address that.
And Brian, what about residents who are working to try to undo all of this as well? I wonder who are some of the people you spoke with on that front.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We interviewed, I think, Dan and I, when we counted last, it was plus 90 people, and then not all of them showed up in our stories because we can't fit the quotes from 90 people, even though we had four stories and all the words that we put together. You know, we spoke to some folks, one woman named Martha Ross, who works on in the south side of Peoria, who had some great comments about, you know, working with folks in the community to help, you know, bring resources to 61605 in Peoria. And, you know, I think we've highlighted some really good citizens, you know, regular citizens in our stories. I mean, Silas Johnson's trying to do some stuff around housing, you know, or, you know, in Springfield on the east side. I think when you look at some of those examples, there are other things that other citizens and residents can do to try to move policy.
Dan, as we end here, you've mentioned a couple of times of your personal experience in Springfield, other parts of you. You're actually from Illinois, and you grew up in a couple of towns across the state. I wonder what you, I imagine that was part of your motivation for doing this, but I wonder what you think want people across the state to be taking away from the reporting that you and Brian have done.
Well, I think one of the things is that a lot of, almost everywhere we went, people were not surprised that we went there to write about racial segregation, right? So they know what happens. They're a little less clear as to why it's happening, and frankly, if you're a white resident and you spend all your time on the white side of town, and you know you do your grocery shopping there, and you go to school there, you might not often think about the big disparities, you know, between the black side of town and the white side of town. So I think that, you know, it's eye opening to first of all just get acclimated to your own, you know, sort of community, all of your community, not just, you know, your own subdivision. But I also think then once you start getting into why our policies working the way they're working, then you realize that it's not this, first, it's not an accident, but it's also not inevitable that there are things that, you know, you as a resident or you as a public official can do, even if it's small steps, to alleviate the, you know, the disparities. And so I think, you know, one thing that was really eye-opening for me, I went into this not really understanding. I'm a public policy reporter, and I didn't quite understand all the different forces that were working. There's not one thing that's happening, but there are a lot of things with similar patterns. And once you start to understand that, then you can start to unwind it and, you know, hopefully address those disparities.
That's Dan Vok. He and Brian Charles are reporters with Governing Magazine. The details of their four-part investigation called Segregated in the Heartland, we will tweet out those stories and those reports. We'll have it at our website at 21stshow.org as well, links to that. Brian, Dan, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having us.
I hope everyone's ready for the colder temperatures, because all across the state, temperatures in the single digits and negatives this past weekend were something we were contending with. And if you haven't already heard, it's going to get a little worse on that front. What can you expect? How can you be prepared? How should you be thinking about these forecasts? Joining us in studio now is Champaign-Urbana meteorologist Andrew Pritchard. Hi, Andrew. Welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with just what people are expecting. I think everyone who's been paying attention knows that tomorrow night and into Wednesday is going to be some pretty cold temperatures, maybe in some cases some record-breaking cold temperatures all throughout the state.
Absolutely. The cool down does begin today, but the core of the coldest air is going to settle over the region again late Tuesday all the way through Thursday morning. And the impacts kind of get worse as you head north. So the coldest in the northern part of the state, trailing off a little bit as you head south, but still dangerously cold as far as central Illinois.
And when we're thinking about wind chill ratings, we're seeing, I saw one map from the National Weather Service, I think from the Lincoln office, maybe as low as 45, 48 below zero possible.
Definitely. Yeah. Anywhere from 30 to 45 below zero for wind chills in central Illinois. And as you head north, we're talking 40 to 50 below zero in northern Illinois, and colder than that if you want to go all the way up to Minnesota and Wisconsin.
And so when we're looking at, without the wind chill even, are we looking at maybe Chicago perhaps breaking a record for cold temperatures as well?
Definitely. The record, the all-time record for coldest temperature in Chicago is negative 27. And right now,
and that's obviously without the wind chill.
Yeah, that's an air temperature. And the National Weather Service in Chicago right now, Tuesday night, they've got a low forecast of 25 below. And then Wednesday night is 30 below. So right around there, both Tuesday and Wednesday night.
And what about the rest of the state? Do you think we might see some record cold air temperatures as well?
Definitely. When you head south, talking about Champaign-Urbana, our record lows are, I think, 13 and 14 below for Tuesday and Wednesday night, and that's exactly where we're going to be both of those nights, right around 15 below.
And so historically speaking, I wonder, this is always interesting when we think about the weather, because I think we think, oh, it's getting warmer. I remember, you know, it was 60 a couple of weeks ago, which is kind of crazy to think about now. Historically speaking, is it pretty typical for us to see a type of cold snap like this where we're getting this Arctic weather this time of year?
This is the time of year it definitely happens. It's funny you mentioned, you know, 60 a few weeks ago. It'll be 40, 50 degrees by the time we get to the weekend. So if that makes it easier to take here midweek, we'll be warming up already this weekend. But, you know, climatologically speaking, January is the coldest month of the year. So this is often when it's going to happen, if it does happen. And, you know, it feels awful, but just think about New Year's Eve 2018. We had a very similar stretch to this where we even had a 24-hour period where we never got above zero, which is possible Wednesday. So just a couple years ago, we dealt with weather similar to this in central Illinois.
So, Andrew, we've talked about how cold it is going to be, but I was also hoping we could talk about how we talk about the cold. And you've been tweeting a lot about this. And in particular, I'm thinking about how we prepare people, how we model these storms or these cold fronts. Where do you think we can go wrong in this sense?
Well, I think we're seeing a slow push towards using more uncertainty and probabilistic forecasting. And this is especially helpful when we're talking about snow, trying to forecast how much snow. You know, we start talking about a potential winter storm a week out, and immediately everyone wants to know how many inches of snow we're going to get. And just looking at 7 days out,
that's just not possible.
It's not possible. And anyone who's, you know, saying that they figured it out is just, it's not accurate. And we're seeing a lot of raw model data. And what I mean when I say that is, these forecast models we have, they're great. They're wonderful tools. They're tools that forecasters 40 and 50 years ago would have loved to have. But they're just that. They're another tool you should have in your toolbox. And a lot of things go into these winter forecasts, especially when we're trying to forecast snow. How much snow we get, there's a lot of variables that go into that. How much liquid precipitation we're going to see. The air temperatures in the atmosphere, they dictate, you know, how fluffy that snow is going to be, or if it's a really heavy, wet snow that doesn't accumulate much. And those are details that we just can't, we don't know a week out.
So realistically, when do you think people should think about having an accurate forecast?
I like to hold off on giving a specific range of snow forecast or snow until 3 or 4 days out. And then you're still giving a range. And then we had a great example just a week ago. We had, you know, the winter storm that came through the Midwest. And even a day before, you know, I was forecasting a range of 4 to 6 inches. But if you paid attention, you know, I was mentioning there's still a chance we could see some rain or sleet mix in. And obviously, if we see a period of rain mixing in there, that's all precipitation that would have fallen to snow. But otherwise didn't. We ended up with an inch of snow, so even the day before, we're having trouble figuring out those details. So when you see a weather map that says we're going to have a winter storm in 5 days, and you see 13.4 inches of snow falling for your city, it's just, I think it does a disservice to your audience when you give a specific amount like that and expect them to understand the uncertainty within that.
And so that said, where do you think is, what is the best way we should think about our weather information, especially as we're thinking about going into this extreme cold weather? What kind of mindset should we have?
Well, I don't pretend to have it perfectly figured out, but I just think a transparent approach is most helpful. You know, some maps started flying around with that winter storm again a week or so ago with forecasts of 12 to 18 inches of snow across central Illinois, which obviously didn't happen. And so I think it's not that you need to not talk about it, but bring up the potential there, but show some of the uncertainty there. Don't just pick one weather model, show the snow output.
So our consumers should know that too, that there's a lot of uncertainty here.
Definitely, yeah. You see the forecast. Getting really specific way out there. Just understand there's a lot of uncertainty, and that's going to be changing as it gets closer.
That's meteorologist Andrew Pritchard. We are going to continue the conversation about this weather tomorrow. We're going to be focusing on schools, shelters, how to decide how schools close down for the day. We'll also look at the different types of warming shelters that people can turn to for help. Andrew, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it. Our website's a good place to go for information for the 21st. We're a production of Illinois Public Media. And I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.